In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. It's now over a quarter of a century since the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 ended most of the violence of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And 26 years on, more information is coming to light that helps us to study the history of the conflict, and particularly the role of the intelligence services. Henry Hemming has written a new book, Four Shots in the Night, which examines this topic in more depth. And he spoke to David Musgrove.
I'm delighted that we have got Henry Hemming on the podcast. He's written a new book, which is Four Shots in the Night. And the book centres around the story of a man, Frank Hegarty, who was murdered in Northern Ireland in 1986. He was Catholic. This was the time of the Troubles. He was assassinated by the IRA. And he was an IRA man, but also a British agent. So, Henry, in your book, you explore how this execution came about, and you consider an even darker undercurrent to the murder that reveals something of the extent of the British intelligence gathering operation in Northern Ireland at the time. So there's a hell of a lot to unpack in there, and we're not going to go too deep into the particular story because it is a bit complicated and would also give away a lot of the book. I'm sure we'll touch on it, but it does invite us to consider the role of intelligence, spies and agents in the Troubles. So that's the way we'll look at this, if that's okay with you.
Yep, sounds good. And thank you for having me on.
No, it's a pleasure. It's good to have you back. So first question, which is quite a difficult one, but I'm going to ask you to have a crack at it, which is, I mentioned the Troubles in the introduction. Can you do your best to briefly summarise the Troubles, which, as you say in your book, is, to quote you, by a country mile, the least understood conflict in recent British history?
I always think the best place to start is with just how long the Troubles lasted. It lasted for 30 years, began in August 1969. It ends with the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. And it takes place for the most part in a part of our country called Northern Ireland. And I say it like that because for some people, Northern Ireland is its own country or its own nation or its own state. But in fact, it's not. It's an administrative region of the UK and it shares many of our laws. I think the point is this conflict was a lot closer than sometimes it's made out to be. And on one side of the conflict, you have the British security forces. So that's the army, MI5, MI6, GCHQ, and the local police. And they're up against a series of paramilitary groups, most famously the IRA. And the next question really is, what were they fighting about? And it's interesting, and I think it's something that's often overlooked, that this began very much as a civil rights campaign. It was people, ordinary people, marching in the street, trying to end discrimination in the region against Catholics. And you had Catholics and Protestants both pushing for this. But very soon, the focus of the conflict changed. It became much more about unification, whether Northern Ireland should remain part of the UK or if it should become part of the Republic of Ireland. And that became the defining issue throughout the Troubles in the years that followed. And I guess the last thing I'd say, if I was trying to summarise the Troubles as someone who knew absolutely nothing about it, is to talk about just the number of people it affected. There were 3,500 people who were killed. There were 50,000 people who were injured. But in some ways, those numbers don't really give you a sense of just how deep this went. The population of Northern Ireland at that time is only about 1.5 million people. And you have very, very few families who are not affected in some way by what happened. But what those numbers also hide is the, I mean, sometimes savage intimacy of these killings, that you would often have situations where an IRA active service unit would target someone who's known to one of those players, and the family of the victim would then often see or know the people who probably killed their loved one in the years and decades that followed. So there's a closeness which is not always immediately apparent when you think of this, and it contributes to an enormous psychological burden for people who lived through this conflict.
Thanks. I think one thing perhaps we should have mentioned to start with is we've talked about the IRA. There's lots of acronyms involved here. Some listeners might not be familiar with the IRA.
It stands for the Irish Republican Army. And the IRA at the very beginning of the Troubles is almost completely different to what it becomes later. And at the very start, it's seen as not quite a joke organisation, but it's a revolutionary organisation. It's non-violent. It believes very much in uniting the working class in Northern Ireland. And only once that has happened, beginning to think about ways to force change and unite the island. But it changes. It changes in late 1969. And there's this critical moment in the history of the whole conflict when a faction breaks away from the original IRA. And that faction is called it calls itself the Provisional IRA. It begins to be known as the Provos, and pretty soon most people around the world are just referring to this as the IRA. And this new faction is absolutely committed to violence. It's more sectarian, it's less interested in uniting the working class, and it will do whatever it takes. It will use bombs, it will use Armalites, it will take violence to the streets of Northern Ireland in order to achieve a united Ireland. And that begins really in December 1969.
Okay, now before we get too deep into things, you have a really interesting discussion at the start of the book about how you researched this, how you navigated a subject which is so complicated, so heated, and where there is a need for impartiality, or you need to try to be impartial. I suppose that's probably one of the biggest challenges in writing anything about this. So maybe a way to look at it is to ask you what sources were and weren't available to you, and how did you approach the topic?
It's a really good question. The sources available to me are those available to everyone, which are in the National Archive, which are in secondary sources and primary sources, people talking about their materials. For the most part, that's where I began. But I also began to conduct a series of interviews with people who were close to the story I'm looking at. This is the story of Frank Hegarty. And this involves speaking to people who had been in the IRA, people who had been working for the British security forces, perhaps in the army, perhaps in the intelligence services, but also speaking to people who had lived through the Troubles in Derry, which is where Frank was from, people who knew Frank themselves and had memories of him. So it was a fascinating experience, slowly earning the trust of all of these different people, sitting down with them or having conversations on the phone, and very slowly piecing together exactly what happened. And in many cases, finding out things which had not been said before, which were not on the record previously. So it was a combination of open source, but also looking behind the scenes, trying to interview people who hadn't spoken beforehand. But in terms of where I come into all this, this book was totally different to my experience of writing other books. In the past, I've written about spies, mostly in the Second World War. I wrote about someone called Maxwell Knight, often known as M, who worked for MI5. I wrote about Bill Stevenson, who was part of MI6. And in all of those cases, I didn't really need to interrogate where I was coming from as a historian. It was sort of fairly obvious that I wasn't rooting for the Nazis and I was going to be pro MI5 or pro MI6. That was fine. But this story is different. And in Four Shots in the Night, I think it's really important for me to acknowledge something about where I'm coming from. The fact that I've grown up in London, that I'm British, that I went to a C of E school, that I'm likely to have some kind of hidden bias towards the British soldiers or the British spies involved in this conflict. But at the same time, I guess by acknowledging it, you take a step towards getting beyond that. And certainly my experience of interviewing people for Four Shots in the Night, I found that as long as I was upfront about exactly where I was coming from and that I didn't have skin in the game. I wasn't trying to support one side or the other. Most people were really happy to talk to me.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And am I right in thinking that quite a few of the people you spoke to who had personal experience of what you're talking about would only speak to you on the assumption of anonymity?
Yeah, you are. And I can still recall the looks on quite a few people's faces. I brought out a recorder and asked if I could record, as in they were shocked even at the idea. So yeah, most people did not want to be recorded and wanted to speak off the record, which I completely respect and completely understand.
Right, so let's talk about intelligence gathering in the Troubles then. Let's go back to sort of the early period. So you would have thought that the gathering of intelligence would have been a key concern as the Troubles began to escalate. But according to your book, MI5, the British Domestic Intelligence Service, wasn't particularly interested in running an intelligence operation in Northern Ireland in the early 1970s. Did I read that right? And if so, why is that?
No, you're absolutely right. And in the early days of the Troubles, MI5 just wanted nothing to do with this. In their judgment, what was happening in Northern Ireland was a security issue. It was one to be dealt with by the army and by the police. And I think it's worth adding that MI5 at that time is a very different organisation to what it becomes by the late 1980s. It's much more right-wing, conservative, military-minded. A lot of the people working for MI5 at that time have experience of being in the army, or they'll often see that job as the next step towards retirement. They don't really fancy the idea of going over to Northern Ireland, trying to infiltrate the IRA. They're more interested in hunting down Soviet spies on the streets of London, or maybe infiltrating a trade union somewhere closer to home. But by the late 1970s, that begins to change. And maybe it's worth adding as well that the attitude within MI6, Britain's Foreign Intelligence Agency, is almost completely different. So they have a history by this point of operating in a very different way, a very distinctive way. They have a track record of identifying enemy leaders who they think they can work with, befriending them out of sight, and then steering them towards a political path. A really good example is Jomo Kenyatta. And he was originally detained by the British. He was labelled a terrorist. But then later he was befriended by an MI6 officer, somebody called Frank Steele. And in the years that followed, he was put on a path to peace and he became the first elected president of independent Kenya. And MI6 wanted to do something pretty similar in Northern Ireland. So in the very early days, you have MI5 saying we want nothing to do with this. But you have MI6 at the same time trying to create dialogue with the IRA leadership. And this becomes a theme throughout the Troubles, that you have these different agencies all operating in the small, same region, Northern Ireland, but they often have very different priorities and they often have very different approaches. And at its best, the system works well in that they're able to reach parts that the other agencies cannot. But at other times, it can become a bit of a mess. And sometimes the rivalries between the different agencies will get in the way of actually trying to achieve peace.
So that's really interesting. You talk about MI5 and MI6, domestic versus foreign. Whose turf was it? Because obviously Northern Ireland is a domestic part of the United Kingdom. So really, the MI6 shouldn't have been anywhere near it, should they?
I know. And this was the MI5 argument. And to begin with, the only reason MI6 were over there was that MI5 said essentially, we want nothing to do with this. Fine, you can do it instead. And then about 5 years later, by the mid-1970s, MI5 decide that they don't like what's happening. They don't like what MI6 are doing, and they arrange for MI6 to have a lesser role, and they begin to play a bigger part. But it's interesting that by the late 70s, you have this big shift inside MI5. There's a new director general, somebody called Howard Smith. He comes from the Foreign Office. He's got a totally different approach to intelligence gathering in Northern Ireland. But you've also got a new generation of MI5 officers, people like Stella Rimington, who had gone to become Director General, and Stephen Lander, who also became DG later on. And they did think that intelligence could play a role in ending the Troubles. And previously, young MI5 officers wanted nothing to do with it. They did not want to be sent out to Belfast. But by the late 1970s, they did. And my book, Four Shots in the Night, is very much about one of the first agents to be taken on after this new approach begins to come into play in the late 1970s, early 80s.
And just moving on slightly longer, so by the mid-1980s, I'm going to drop in another quote from your excellent book. You say the British Army, SIS, MI5 and the local police in Northern Ireland had spun an intelligence web that now covered most of the region and were running the largest counter-terrorist operation anywhere in the world. So things have suddenly escalated to a considerable extent. What happened and why? And perhaps also you should just tell us what SIS is, because there's another acronym there that people might not be familiar with.
Absolutely. SIS is another way of saying MI6. And I guess for the rest of this interview, I'll keep saying MI6 just to keep it clear. But in the book, I go for SIS. What happened? The main thing that happened was an IRA series of attacks on one day in August in 1979. And one of these attacks was at Warren Point. And this is an attack in which 18 British soldiers were killed. The other one was the attack which killed Lord Mountbatten and three other people who were also on his boat at that time. And this was a catalyst to huge change. This was one of these moments when the British government woke up. Thatcher visited the region. She agreed that something had to be done. Something had to change. And although there were some people who already believed the answer was to have a more intelligence-led approach, they weren't really being listened to before that particular day. But something about the nature of this attack and how savage it seemed to be and the apparent strength of the IRA made Thatcher and those around her feel we need to try something else because what we're doing already is clearly not working. So there is a shift that begins at government level, which leads to more resources going into intelligence gathering. So the army begins to take on more agents. MI5 is sending out more officers. They're also recruiting more agents. The police also begin to prioritize intelligence gathering. And over the years that follow, all of these policy shifts begin to bear dividend. And you have many more agents, you have more intelligence, and you get to a point where there is the largest, what's called counter-terrorist operation anywhere in the world. It's an extraordinary turnaround and it's remarkably quick as well.
Now, we've talked a bit about the British interest in Northern Ireland. Were there spies and agents working for other countries, for the Republic of Ireland and others at the time?
So yes, there definitely were some Irish spies. The Irish police had its own agent-running operation. And we know that the Irish coordinated with the British. And the most famous spy was someone called Sean O'Callaghan, who later wrote a memoir of his experiences. It's a fantastic book. It's called The Informer. And he's actually also responsible for our current king, Charles III, still being alive. It's an amazing story. And it's one of the ones I found when I was researching Four Shots in the Night. So he was part of an active service unit, part of the IRA, and they devised a plan. And their plan was to plant a bomb in a bathroom behind the Royal Box in a theatre where they knew that Charles and Diana would be going to attend a concert. This was going to be a concert for the Prince's Trust. The headline act was set to be Duran Duran. And Sean O'Callaghan was the man given the job of planting this bomb and then tiling it up inside the bathroom so nobody could see it. And we know that this technology would have worked, because the IRA would use almost identical technology to plant a bomb the following year in Brighton. And that's when they very nearly killed Margaret Thatcher in the Brighton bombing. But in 1983, they were going to do it to Charles and Diana. It didn't happen because the man given the job of planting the bomb was in fact a spy. He was reporting to the Irish police, but very soon he'd be reporting to MI5 as well. So, yeah, there were a range of spies, including the great Sean O'Callaghan.
I mean, that is an incredible story, and you just imagine how the course of history would have changed if that hadn't happened. Okay, was there much focus from the British side on trying to infiltrate the unionist groups as well as the Republicans? So the IRA, obviously on the Republican side here.
There certainly was some focus, but nowhere near as much as there was on getting inside the IRA and the, here's another acronym, the INLA, the Irish National Liberation Army. The most common accusation against the British security forces when it comes to this, when it comes to getting spies inside these extreme Protestant unionist groups, the common accusation is that, yes, they had some spies inside them, but they weren't doing enough to bring these groups to a halt. And the accusation is that because these groups were largely attacking the IRA, the British were happy to turn a blind eye because they had the same shared objective. That's not entirely true, and there's very good evidence that a lot of lives were saved, but there's also good evidence that they had spies inside these groups and they were responsible for a number of killings. One of them is somebody called Brian Nelson. He was a British Army agent inside the UDA, that's the Ulster Defence Association, and he rose to become the UDA head of intelligence. So that meant that killers who were part of the UDA would go to him and say, essentially, who should we kill? Can you give us the details of where they live and what they look like? And Brian Nelson was later tried in court. And there's pretty good evidence to suggest that he was sometimes getting his information from the army. And that, of course, is where the accusation of collusion comes from. And Brian Nelson was later, I think, given 10 years in jail for what he did. So the answer to your question is yes, there were agents inside these unionist paramilitary groups, but not as many. And there are problems over exactly what they're being tasked with doing and whether the British were sometimes turning a blind eye more than they should have done.
Okay, so what sort of intelligence were the British authorities and their agents looking to gather? What did they want to know?
So most of the intelligence they were trying to get, you can divide into two different categories. The most obvious is what's called tactical intelligence. And that is basically about where a bomb is going to be planted, where an IRA attack is about to happen, something like that. And that's usually passed on to the army or to the police. But the other type of intelligence is called strategic intelligence. And that's what MI5 is much more interested in. And that's to do with the inner workings of the IRA leadership. It's about who's plotting to oust whom, who is trying to push towards a political, peaceful solution, who's trying to do the opposite. And so that involves getting agents close to figures like Martin McGuinness, who's an important character in Four Shots in the Night. And most of the time you have agents who will give you either one type of intelligence or the other. But every now and again, you have one that can provide both. And one of these is, again, a character that comes up in the book quite a lot, an agent codenamed Steak Knife, who's been in the news quite a lot recently, who died, in fact, last year. And he's someone who was part of something called the IRA Internal Security Unit, nicknamed the Nutting Squad. And this was a unit which specialized in interrogating suspected informers. And then if they were given the order, would carry out the execution or the murder of this victim. And because of his role inside this unit, Steak Knife not only knew about some of the attacks that were going on, but he was also privy to information from the likes of Martin McGuinness, Gerry Adams, other senior figures in the movement. And one of the interesting details I found when I was researching this is that Steak Knife's car was wired for sound, and that often Gerry Adams would be sitting with him talking about what's going on inside the IRA. This is all fairly well documented. And this would all be recorded. And when a visiting politician came over to Northern Ireland to be shown around the army barracks and to be told about what the British were doing, they'd almost always be played one of these tapes of Gerry Adams talking about what's going on, recorded inside Steak Knife's car. And that gives you maybe just kind of an insight into just how much intelligence they were beginning to get by the end of the 1980s. and also, yeah, the level of access that some of these agents managed to achieve.
I guess we might hear a little more about Stakeknife in the course of this conversation, but just to stop you again, you've mentioned a couple of names there, Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams, just in case any of our listeners aren't familiar with those two people. Might you be able to just give us a little more information about those two people?
Yep, they are two really different characters to one another, and they're a fascinating double act because they work incredibly well together. And although their characters change during the course of the Troubles, I think it's fair to say that throughout this armed conflict, Martin McGuinness is seen within the IRA as a military commander that everyone respects. He has the trust of all of the IRA volunteers. But the paradox with him is that from a fairly early stage, by the early 1980s, there are signs that he's beginning to think this military victory is actually out of reach. And the only way we can end this conflict is to try and find a political solution. And there's a moment in the early 1980s when MI5 begins to understand this. And they imagine that McGuinness is actually someone they want to keep in place. They don't necessarily want him in jail. They don't want someone else running the IRA. They imagine that if he continues to be the person mostly running the IRA, there's a good chance that the organization can move towards peace. And Gerry Adams is also someone who, during the 1980s, makes, I think, a really brave decision to begin to put out feelers, begin to investigate the possibility of finding some kind of political compromise. And I say it's brave because he is risking his life in doing that. He is making himself vulnerable to a plot within the IRA. He knows that there are other people in the same organization who are absolutely adamant there should be no political compromise ever. But he and McGuinness are two people who begin to realize that there's an alternative, and they have the courage to begin to push for it, even though it's at great personal risk to themselves.
I wonder, you've talked about how the MI5 might have been interested in political solutions. How far were British politicians aware of what was going on in the secret services during the Troubles, do you think?
It's a really good question. And this is one of the things that I found really surprising when I was researching Four Shots in the Night. When I interviewed people, they'd often talk about decisions going all the way up to number 10 Downing Street, to a spy's report landing on Thatcher's desk. And there was definitely a sort of an understanding that Margaret Thatcher was a really important part of this, that she was the kind of kingpin making decisions, almost orchestrating this intelligence operation. But it's simply not true. And as soon as you get into the archives, as soon as you get into the historical accounts of what was going on at that time, you realize that for the most part, number 10 was not interested in what was going on in Northern Ireland. They saw it as a distraction. They saw it as something which they could not helpfully solve or should not really be getting involved in. And the biggest mistake they made was imagining that for there to be a political solution, you needed first to have peace. So they thought, just leave it to the army, leave it to the police. Once they figured everything out, then we as the politicians can get involved. But of course, they had it the wrong way around. And you can only really get to a peaceful military solution once the political side of things is underway. So the two have to go in tandem. So a lot of the time, MI5 are operating in the region without describing to number 10 or to a minister in the Home Office exactly what they were doing. Yes, they would talk about overall targets and in a very broad sense what the strategy was, but it's surprising just how little detail they would get into. And I guess how much autonomy MI5 certainly had during the 1980s.
It's so interesting, that aspect of things. Now, look, the world of agents, double agents and spies, it's a topic you've written about extensively in your books. This one, the moral dimension here is particularly challenging, I suppose. I wonder, what were the ethics and dilemmas involved in gathering intelligence in what was a domestic British context?
Maybe the best way to answer that is I could talk about one particular example and then just get into the ethics and the moral dilemma contained in that. So the main character in my book is a guy called Frank Hegarty, And he was approached in early 1984 by the IRA, and he was given a large cache of weapons to look after. He had to go and find a place to hide these, and he decided to hide them in a cemetery close to where he lived. He then told his handler, who was part of the army, part of the army's specialist agent running unit called the Force Research Unit. So you then have a situation where the handler is aware of this information. He knows there are some IRA weapons, they're in the cemetery. What does he do? And this is the dilemma he faces. You'd think this is hardly a dilemma. You'd think the most obvious thing to do is simply tell the police. The police can then move in, remove the weapons. The weapons cannot be used. But if he were to do that, then it's almost certain that the man who has given him this information, Frank Hegarty, would come under suspicion of being an agent. Very, very soon, the IRA Nutting Squad would be knocking at his door. Very soon after that, he'd be interrogated. And very soon after that, he'd probably be killed. And the handler knows this. He has a duty of care towards his agent. He needs to try and protect this man's life. But what's also confusing the decision that he has to make is his understanding that if nothing happens, if these weapons are allowed to remain where they are, then his agent, Frank, will become more trusted. He might receive more information in the months to come, and then the army handler will be able to save more lives down the line. And the only other thing to add is the time pressure. So, I mean, already it's sounding like a complicated decision, one you want to take advice on and maybe spend a couple of weeks really trying to figure it out. But in a situation like this, you, as the handler, do not have long to make that decision. You have to act fast if it is a situation where you feel, actually, we do need to act. We do need to get these weapons out of circulation. And this is the basic dilemma that most agent handlers faced, sometimes on a daily basis. I call it the spy master's dilemma. The dilemma is, am I going to save more lives if I act on this intelligence, or will I save more lives if I do not? And it's a dilemma that's at the heart of all espionage, of all intelligence gathering. You can see the same kind of thing during the Second World War with the information that was coming out of Bletchley Park. There were certainly occasions when information about the whereabouts of a particular U-boat Wolfpack was not passed on to the convoy that it was about to target, simply because they were worried that if they were to do that, that would reveal the source of their information, which in this case was hut number 8 in Bletchley Park. And you see the same thing in Northern Ireland, but usually on a much, much smaller scale. And these are the kinds of ethical questions that these handlers had to face. I think the other thing to add to this is that most of the handlers who are being asked to make these incredibly difficult life or death decisions did not have detailed training in exactly what they should do in these types of situations. But they also didn't have much of a sense of what they should do in terms of the law. So the legal side of this was confusing. It was not really spelled out to them, mainly because there was no set of absolutely clear legislation describing what you can and cannot do as an agent handler in a situation like that. There's one moment which I always think sums up the whole predicament really well, which is in 1986, and it's when a senior special branch officer, somebody called Raymond White, goes to speak to Margaret Thatcher, and he's in 10 Downing Street, and he tells her, and I can quote, "Some of my handlers are asking their agents to do things that technically could be construed as criminal acts." And Ray White is an experienced police officer. He's got a degree in law. He understands what's going on. And he also understands the potential danger that his handlers are in. And the response from number 10 is, and I quote again, "Please continue to do what you're doing, but for goodness sake, try not to get caught." And that speaks to what's going on. There's a sense of, we don't really know what we're allowed to do. There isn't really law covering this, but let's just hope it never gets out. And at the time, this to an extent worked in the sense that it allowed this intelligence operation to become enormous. But these actions and some of the serious crimes that were carried out by some of the agents inside the IRA or close to the IRA would later catch up with them. And the final part of my book is about something called Operation Canova, which is a large murder investigation focused on the activities of one particular British agent, someone we've mentioned briefly, called Steak Knife. And that really is an example of history catching up with what was going on at the time.
I mean, it's incredible, isn't it, to think of the pressure that these people were under having to make those decisions. And it comes through very clearly in your book, without the rule book, without the playbook of where the boundaries lay. I mean, that must have been an awful position to find themselves in, but also an awful position probably for the people on the other side of the fence who maybe weren't clear about what was going to happen to them. So I wonder, what sort of people were the British intelligence agents attracted to recruiting as spies and agents in Northern Ireland during this time? What sort of people were they trying to get hold of?
It was a huge range of different people, and it could be everyone from a party official inside Sinn Féin. It could be an IRA paramilitary. It could be a loyalist paramilitary. Or it could just be someone who has a lot of friends, who is often down the pub and is willing to pass on what they've heard, something this is sometimes referred to as an eyes and ears agent or an access agent. You might have a farmer who lives in a remote part of the region who's willing to offer up some of his house to be used for meetings with agents so that they can meet in safety. It was an enormous range, but it was, I mean, maybe predictably, it was the people you would not expect. It was the drivers. It was the quiet members of the family. It was people who could blend into the background. But what's really striking is just because of the scale of this operation was just how many people were involved in it towards the end. There's an extraordinary moment where a member of a group called the Consultative Group in the Past, Father Dennis Bradley, he's the chair of this group. And as part of the work that he was doing, he was trying to find out more about what went on during the Troubles, trying to deal with the legacy of the Troubles. And as part of his work, he was allowed access to classified information, which talked about just how many agents there were operating in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. And he was later interviewed about this. And he said that at any one time, there were 800 people working as undercover agents. The adult population of Northern Ireland was just 1 million at that time. But I guess what's also interesting is the reaction to what he said from a senior intelligence officer who apparently scoffed when he heard this number 800 and said it was much larger than that.
You're going to have to generalise here, but what do you think was driving people to take up those roles as spies and agents? Was it money? Were they offered money? Or was it more often the case of wishing to have an influence in the direction of the Troubles?
It was usually a combination of things. Money was certainly a part of it, and it could be more of a motivation for some people than for others. And even me saying that, it immediately sounds like greed, like someone just wanting to get rich from doing this. But a lot of the time, it would be someone who has a problem with debt, has a mortgage they're trying to pay off, or maybe has a wedding to pay for or a funeral and doesn't have enough money. And if the security forces find out about this and they can exploit this, that can be a way of getting information. Revenge is another really important motivating factor. So a lot of people who had lost a relative or a loved one as a result of an IRA attack would be hugely motivated to work for the security forces providing information. And I guess it's also worth adding, some people were driven by a really pure idealistic motivation. They just wanted peace. They wanted the region to be free from conflict. They wanted the Troubles to end. There are also occasions when individuals were targeted and effectively blackmailed into becoming undercover agents. One of the most famous examples is a Sinn Féin politician called Dennis Donaldson. And he's someone who almost certainly was having an affair with another IRA man's wife. And the story goes that the police found out about this before the IRA man did. And they went to him and said, listen, if you work for us, we won't tell. And that's how his career began. And maybe the only other motivating factor to touch on is to do with ego, to do with feeling that you're not respected, feeling that you're not important, feeling that you're not being listened to. And if you're in a situation like that and a series of people come up to you, approach you, make you feel important, offer you money, but also tell you that you're important, we want to know what you think and the information that you can provide, we think you can become a fantastic agent, words to that effect, that can have a really powerful impact. And that can be enough to persuade someone who's wavering to agree to become an agent.
Look, getting towards the end of the conversation, can we look at the big picture a bit again? So we talked about how perhaps there was a combination of strategic and political decisions happening at certain points. I wonder, how did this truly extensive intelligence gathering operation that you've talked about impact on and influence the history of the Troubles? And I'm not talking so much about whether it stopped particular terrorist events happening, but on a bigger picture, did this covertly acquired information inform high-level political decision-making and strategy?
It's a really important question. And there are various historians with different approaches to it. My argument that I make in Four Shots in the Night is that intelligence was decisive in ending the Troubles. And what I focus on are two major impediments to peace and the fact that they were removed by the time of the Good Friday Agreement and exactly why these two impediments were removed. The first was that the IRA, certainly by the early 1980s, still believed that a military victory was possible. They thought they'd be able to force the British Army out of Northern Ireland and to achieve unification basically by force. And the second impediment to peace was that Sinn Féin at that time was not a viable political force. They had a very small showing in the elections, which they had begun to stand in, and they were not seen as a force that the Protestants or the Unionists were willing to negotiate with. And these were two big problems. From the early 1980s, you begin to have MI5 agents working their way inside Sinn Féin. And rather than being told to disrupt what's going on inside Sinn Féin, they're told to support all the efforts for Sinn Féin to do better at the polls, to become a more credible political force, and to keep moving towards peace. So on the one hand, you have MI5 trying to turn Sinn Féin into a more convincing political entity. And on the other side, you have tens, if not hundreds of agents, either close to or inside the IRA, who are doing everything they can to reduce its capability as a military force. And there's this incredible statistic that in the early 1990s, it's believed that something like 8 out of every 10 IRA operations were being called off. And they're being called off usually as a result of some kind of intelligence breakthrough or activity. In other words, the operation has been compromised. Someone in the unit thinks we've got a spy in our midst, or the security forces are already aware of what we're going to do. And the effect of that is that by the early to mid 1990s, most IRA volunteers realize not so much the game is up, but a military victory is almost certainly not on the cards. And so by the time Tony Blair arrives in 1998, and he's there to oversee the Good Friday Agreement, and I don't want to detract in any way from his skill as a politician or as a negotiator, and it was incredibly impressive what he did. However, by the time he arrived, the two main stumbling blocks had been removed, and I think the reason that it happened was due to the intelligence work of the last 15 years.
That was Henry Hemming. His book, Four Shots in the Night, A True Story of Espionage, Murder and Justice in Northern Ireland, goes into much more detail on the role of the secret services in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, framed around the story of the murder of Frank Hegarty. If you want to understand more about him and how his life is intertwined with that of Agent Stakeknife, then it's well worth a read. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.